Making disciples of all nations. We need to put feet to our faith as we seek to fulfill the Great Commission. The inspiring lives of 19th century missionaries refute the anti-Christian propaganda which is predominant today. Educational institutions and many governments around the world are enamored with Islam and other Eastern religions. From so many sides, we are being bombarded with guilt, manipulation, and disinformation. We hear people saying, Christianity plunged Europe into the Dark Ages. That is a lie. The Dark Ages weren't that dark. The Middle Ages were, in fact, very enlightened. It's during the Middle Ages that Christians invented hospitals, universities, libraries, built the greatest architectural masterpieces in history, the cathedrals, with stained glass windows, 1,000 years ago. It's not that dark at all. They say Christianity introduced slavery to Africa. That's actually Islam did. The people of Africa knew nothing about suffering until the missionaries arrived. That's what Kenneth Gunda said. God is the ultimate racist. I heard that from a minister of our government not that long ago. And there's all kinds of other ridiculous, blasphemous assertions. What is so incredible about this train of disinformation, this campaign by so many in Hollywood and the news media, is the gullibility of so many people jumping on the bandwagon. That millions, many millions of gullible people have actually swallowed this vile diatribe is bad enough. However, many Christians have also come to accept these and many other slanderous accusations. The Greatest Century of Missions book, which you should have all received a copy of yesterday, is an antidote to all this poison. Facts are stubborn things. And the inspiring lives and incredible achievements against all odds by bold and brave missionaries of the 19th century, it exposes the fallacies and the fraud of these malicious and ignorant assertions. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Who put darkness for light and light for darkness. Who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. The greatest century of missions exposes the reality of heathenism which confronted these pioneers of the gospel. It kicks the legs out from under these Marxist myths that slander the saints and seek to rewrite history. The spectacular achievements of God-fearing Christians in confronting cannibalism, child sacrifice, widow burning, and slavery needs to be understood. The missionaries of the 19th century steadfastly resisted the Islamic slave trade, and they set many tens of thousands of captives free. We need to make these eye-opening exposés of what Africa, the Middle East, and Asia were really like before the advent of the gospel became widely known, and how much we are all indebted to the sacrificial services of those dedicated disciples who laid down their lives, laying solid foundations for the future. When pioneer missionary to Persia, Henry Martin, sought to present his Persian New Testament to the Shah of Persia, he was challenged with an ultimatum to declare that Muhammad is the prophet of God. Henry Martin boldly refused and asserted that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. His opponents were outraged, and they threatened to have his tongue torn out for blasphemy. When Robert Moffat first applied to the London Missionary Society, he was rejected. His proposal to marry Mary Smith was also refused by her parents. Yet Robert persisted and persevered, and on his first missionary expedition to South Africa, he succeeded in bringing to Christ the most notorious bandit and murderer in the country. Finally, Mary Smith's parents relented and gave permission for her to marry, and she sailed to South Africa, where they married. And for the next 50 years, the Moffats, Robert and Mary Moffat, became one of the greatest husband and wife mission teams in history. Robert Moffat succeeded in translating the complete Bible, the first complete Bible into an African language, which was the Tswana language. on this printing press, the first printing press north of the Orange River. And the church, which are built to accommodate 800 converts. Here you can see under the London Missionary Society in Kuruman board, some of the famous missionaries who served there. And notice, seven down, David Livingstone. This was David Livingstone's first mission station at Kuruman. And from Kuruman, Robert Moffat took the gospel as far as Matabeleland. He lived a long and productive life in Africa. Very productive, hardworking, became friends of Lubin Kula, the king of the Matabele, and his son became the first missionary to the Matabele. When Britain was the greatest economic and military power in the world, Queen Victoria was asked by a visiting African prince, "What is the secret of England's greatness?" Queen Victoria presented him with a Bible saying, "Here is the secret of England's greatness. It is the word of God." That is why England is no longer great. They've turned away from the Bible. When they were true to the Bible, God blessed them. And the cathedrals, the greatest architectural masterpiece in history, testified to that. Samuel Zwema chose to oppose Islam, and he resolved to engage the enemy on the soil of Arabia, the birthplace of Muhammad. If we want the 21st century to be the greatest century of missions and revival, then we will need to learn from those Christian pioneers whom God used to make the 19th century the greatest century of Christian advance so far. In 1801, Protestant Christianity was concentrated in Europe and North America. And except for a few small Christian enclaves, Asia was almost untouched by the gospel. There were some significant Christian communities in Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and a small number of Dutch settlers at the southernmost tip of Africa, but otherwise Africa was mostly unevangelized. However, by the end of the 1800s, Christianity was a world religion, with churches established in almost every country on the planet. How Christianity became the first truly international religion in just one century is an amazing story. What inspired these incredibly effective missionary pioneers and the successful strategies that they used needs to be prayerfully examined if we are to be more effective in world evangelism. While the 20th century can boast greater numbers of missionaries in the field and greater numbers of converts, the 19th century saw far greater depth of impact for the gospel, especially when we consider the very limited resources available to these missionary pioneers and the overwhelming difficulties, dangers, and obstacles which they had to overcome. The missionary pioneers of the 19th century clearly present the most inspiring examples of Christian courage and perseverance against all odds. The incredible adventures of these soul winners, these nation builders, these culture shapers, makes for exhilarating reading. The exploits and the achievements of these extraordinary Christian heroes and heroines have been mostly forgotten in the countries where they were sent out from. For this reason, it is perhaps appropriate that this book, celebrating some of the adventures, sacrifices, and achievements of these missionary pioneers, that this book comes from Africa. For it is we in Africa who have benefited so greatly from the 19th century missionary movement. In this time of secularism and skepticism, some may be surprised to hear how much these missionary pioneers are honored in Africa. Dr. David Livingstone, for example, has two towns in Africa named after him, Livingstone in Zambia, Livingstonia in Malawi. Other towns in Africa which were named after Europeans, such as Stanleyville, Salisbury, Elizabethville, Fort Victoria, they have had their names changed. But Livingstone and Livingstonia remain as a tribute to a man who brought faith to the hearts of the Africans. And he struck fear in the hearts of the Arab slave traders. David Livingstone is known as a liberator in Africa. Similarly, while statues of many colonial figures such as Cecil John Rhodes have been toppled and removed, statues and monuments to missionary pioneers such as David Livingstone retain their prominence and reflect the deep respect which Africans still have for these missionary pioneers. When we were celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birth of David Livingstone in 2013, I visited Livingston to conduct the final Livingston 200 missions conference there, which was even covered by national TV with the mayor's office in attendance. And we had already gone across 12 countries in 7 months, Livingston 200 mission. When we got to Livingstonia, we were amazed to find 8 statues to David Livingstone, many of which were new, some of which had only just been built that year. So Livingstone is still building statues to David Livingstone. There have, of course, been many concerted attempts to discredit the memory of the early missionaries. Karl Marx, the founder of communism, declared that the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. And from the time I was first converted in 1977, I have heard the most violent, vicious slanders against the 19th century missionary movement. At one of the first missions conferences I ever attended, a missiology professor from Stellenbosch, Dominie Nico Smit, declared, "The missionaries did not believe that black people had souls. They taught that Africans were the firewood of hell." Now, at the time, as a new convert, I didn't know very much about anything. But what he said sounded so outrageous, so self-contradictory, that I actually stood up in a plenary session of this missions conference and said, which missionaries taught this? Did David Livingstone or Robert Moffat teach us? Dominie Smit looked a little surprised. He said, no, not them. Did C.T. Studd believe these things? Did Mary Slessor believe these things? He started to look uncomfortable. No, not them. Well, which missionaries taught this, I asked, because I don't understand why anyone would have come to Africa as a missionary, many of them dying of disease here in the field, if they did not believe that the people of Africa were souls for whom Christ died. Didn't many of the missionaries die bringing the gospel to Africa? Why would they have done that? Anyone recognize whose tomb this is? It's in Mozambique, in the Zambezi Valley. Mary Livingstone, David Livingstone's wife, buried in the Zambezi Valley. Why is she buried there? Because the Livingstones loved the people of Africa. The university professor, Dominie Smit, never answered my question. He drifted off in some anecdotes about some heartless church members that he knew who had bad relations with people of other races. Well, I wondered what on earth did that have to do with the missionaries of the 19th century who had opened up Africa for the gospel, often at the cost of their own lives. Although I did not know much about God's law at the time, I had the uncomfortable feeling that I'd just heard someone bearing false witness against Christians of another era who were not present to be able to answer the slander. It seems cowardly to make us a football out of our spiritual fathers. I've always been interested in history, and when I was converted to Christ in 1977, I was overwhelmed with the conviction that I was called to missions. Throughout the last 40 years, I've never doubted that call. I've always been something of a bookworm, so I naturally tended to gravitate towards history books, and as my knowledge of missionary history increased, I was astounded at the general ignorance in the church concerning our heritage. I was most disappointed at the tendency of so many speakers at missions conferences to disparage the missionary pioneers who had laid the foundations of the church in Africa. I've been to a lot of missions conferences. I've heard a lot of nonsense spoken there against missionaries of the past. I could not help wondering if these speakers really thought that we would have done a better job. Oh, it's so easy to criticize, like people in a stadium during a football match. I mean, they could do so much better than a soccer player there, and the referee's blind and stupid, and people sitting in their armchair at home watching TV with a beer or Coke in their hand, and they all got an opinion like they would do better in the field. The arrogance. But Christians today, sitting in comfort, eating Kentucky Fried Chicken, checking their iPads and Blackberries while they drink Coca-Cola, and they criticizing the missionaries who were out there slogging through the veldt before there were any roads or any bridges built. Would they have even ventured into the field? Hindsight is also all very well, but pioneers do not have the benefit of the hindsight of anyone who's gone before, because they're the pathfinders. The one who goes in front, he doesn't have anyone's insights, guidance. He doesn't have the grammars, the dictionaries, the maps. So of course they would have made mistakes. How else would they have learned? For us to criticize people who sacrifice so much seems shallow, superficial, hypocritical, pharisaical. As I ventured into the mission fields of Mozambique, Angola, and Sudan, my respect for these missionaries has only increased. I was reading Livingstone's Travels when I retraced much of his steps in the Shiri Valley of Malawi and the Zambezi Valley of Mozambique in the 1980s, while I was doing primary research for In the Killing Fields of Mozambique book. In 1989, when I was captured by communist troops in Mozambique and flown by Russian pilots and Soviet Mi-8 HIP helicopters to Tet, I was intrigued to see how Livingstone's description of Tet back in the 1850s could so accurately have been applied to Tet in 1989 as well. Dead bodies floating down the river, burned out villages, and more. The devastation from the Arab slave traders, which he recorded in the Zambezi expedition of 1858 to 1864. It could have also described the scorched earth policy of the communist Frelimo government and their Soviet allies in the 1980s. On another occasion, as I was going down some of the worst roads I've ever experienced in the Shesheki area, today they've got a lovely new road which the Germans built in the Shesheki Bridge, where there used to be the ferry, but so people who younger than me may not remember what the Shesheki Road used to be. It's one of the worst ever. But I remember some of the trials and tribulations of David Livingstone in that very area. And as I've regularly had to remind our young volunteers on a mission who complain about the bad roads, David Livingstone had to walk where we drive. And he had to walk across an Africa that had no roads, no bridges, no shops, and no hospitals. Neither was clean water available. As Livingstone reported after his first missionary journey, "I've drunk water swarming with insects, thick with mud, putrid with rhinoceros urine and buffalo dung." Hacking his way through dense rainforests, walking for days in pouring rain, totally drenched with all of his equipment, either rusting or rotting. If it was metal, it was rusting. If it was canvas, it was rotting. Livingstone persevered across the continent. Hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing their territory. His life was often in danger by Muslim slave raiders. He was mauled by a lion. He was charged by rhino. He was laid low with fever on over 60 occasions. The afflictions that David Livingstone was called to endure in opening up Africa for the gospel and opposing the slave trade tested the limits of human endurance. Leeches, maggots, putsy flies, cholera, pneumonia, sunburn, huge sores, tropical ulcers, malaria plagued him. Yet his indomitable spirit rose as he set his heart to accomplish goals which seemed humanly impossible. He persevered, and as a result of his sacrificial labors, the slave trade in Central and East Africa was exposed and it was eradicated. Livingstone's steadfast example was used by the Lord to inspire many hundreds of men and women to devote their lives to African missions. Mary Slessor, for example, went to Calabar, present-day Nigeria. Dr. Kenneth Fraser was inspired to go to Moreland in southern Sudan, where our mission has its base. The Christians in Moreland have been under regular aerial bombardment, scorched earth campaigns, have endured some of the worst persecution by the Arab Muslim government of Sudan, churches being bombed by supersonic MiG jet fighters. The birthplace of Christianity in southern Sudan, Fraser Cathedral, bombed 10 times, destroyed 3 times, rebuilt each time. This is where Kenneth Fraser started his mission. He trained the first chaplains, the first medics, the first teachers, and the first pastors. When I went on my second missionary journey to Moreland, the church where we were to have our Muslim evangelism workshop was burned out and bombed by helicopter gunships. And there were the Christian pastors standing with a Christian flag inside the ashes of the remains of this church. And they still wanted me to teach them how to win their enemies to Christ. We could see the good seed that had been planted in good ground by Kenneth Fraser 100 years before. There they were rebuilding the very church. We took the Bibles, the books, had conferences in the forest because the church in town was bombed. Our first conference in Moreland. Teacher training college in Moreland. La Ro, the slave trader's tree. Under this tree, the Arabs used to tie up and tether the Moro people and take them off as slaves to the Nile River and up to Khartoum. Kenneth Fraser started the first Bible study under this tree. The church, you can see the roof just in the background beyond. That's a church that will not die. The church has been built and it was destroyed 3 times and rebuilt each time. The first Bible in the Moro language, which we had the privilege of delivering, bombed on Sunday morning when we delivered it. The first 3,000 Bibles in the Moro language in front of the church that will not die, Fraser Cathedral. The Moro people are a fruit of the ministry of Kenneth Fraser. One of his disciples, one of his early converts, Canon Ezra Lawiri, translated the Bible into Moro. Kenneth Fraser had done the Gospel in Acts. His disciple Ezra Lawiri did the rest of the Bible. In 1991, when he was on his way to Juba, close to the spot where I'm standing here, he was killed in an ambush with the Arabs. And his deacon, Bulunduli, who later became the bishop, was entrusted with the manuscript. He got it to us. We got it printed. Here, as we were training the people in evangelism explosion, EE, we were bombed on Sunday morning. We'd had a week of training pastors, chaplains, teachers in evangelism explosion. And as we came to the Sunday service, we're going through the EE program, training the people, reciting the people. If you were to die tonight, do you know for sure that you're going to heaven? And the cry went up, Antonovs. And everyone ran out the door. Well, there wasn't a door, the doorway, because high thatch roof. And as I came out from under the thatch, I was the last to leave the church. And as I came out from under the thatch, I could hear the high-pitched screams of the bombs. And the bombs were coming. And I knew the screaming was too high. There was no time to reach the trench or the foxhole where we could get some cover from the bombings. I just had to lie flat on the ground. And as I fell on the ground shook. 5 1,000-kilogram bombs landed, exploding close by. And shrapnel hissed through the air, and everything that was flung up in the air, the dirt, piece of branches came pummeling down. And I got up after that bombing and to see that the American missionaries I'd brought there to help were all right. And then the people start to scream again, Antonov turned around, and it was coming to drop more bombs on us. And I saw 2, then 3 bombs coming down, little black dots getting bigger and bigger, heard the screams, and there was nowhere to go. And of course, your body says run, but run where? You might run into the bomb. The only thing you can do in a bombing is lie flat. There's no space in the trenches. They were full of people lying on top of one another even. There's no space for me. So I just lay flat on the ground, and I felt as the bomb went through the trees next to me and exploded. I felt in my side a big kick, and I thought, that's it. I expected that I'd been hit by shrapnel. You know, at first you have a dull pain. You don't feel pain much, whether you fall off a bicycle or cut yourself. There's no pain immediately. But as I got up, 3 more bombs had dropped all over, including one 17 meters from where I was standing, lying. And as I brushed away to try and see the injury, I couldn't see any blood. And it must have been a bark of a tree because my rib cage was cracked. I had 3 cracked ribs. So I was in pain for the next 6 weeks. Every time I laughed or sneezed or coughed, it was very sore. But there's nothing you can do for cracked ribs. It takes about 6 weeks to heal. So I must have had a piece of tree bark that was blown against me, because if it was metal, it would have gone straight through, of course. And do you know, after that bombing, they recontinued the service. How many churches, do you know, would continue the service after experiencing a bombing? 8 1,000-kilogram bombs had been dropped on the church. All the bombs landed within 100 meters. That's the size of a football field. How many people do you think were killed? We had 3 people in church that day. All 8,000 kilogram bombs fell within 100 meters of the church. One within 17 meters of the church. Not one person was killed. Not one person was seriously injured. We had just read earlier that morning, Psalm 91. The angel of the Lord sent to protect us. And we experienced it. Not only did we not lose anyone, we gained people. There were more people in church after bombing than there were before. And the highlight of the service was presenting the Bible, the first Bible in a moral language, which Ezra Lawiri had given his life for. And as I remind them that we're just a short distance from where the Bible translator lay buried, here we are presenting the first Bibles in a moral language. How much clearer can it be? The Bible is a message of life and death. Some people hate the Word of God so much they're willing to kill to stop it. Others love the Word of God so much they're willing to die to advance it. This is a message of life and death. Do you know the first Bibles printed in English by William Tyndale had to be translated in Germany, printed in Germany, smuggled from the Netherlands into England in bales of cotton, and all 6,000 of the first printing of the English New Testament were intercepted and burned. Bibles in English were illegal in England. William Tyndale was burned alive for the crime of translating the Bible into English. The Bible we have in English, people gave their lives that we could have in English, and in many other languages too. Well, at the end of the service, 5-hour church service, here with Chaplain John, Chaplain Moses, after one of the greatest church services has ever been a privilege to be part of. Here's one of the bomb craters and some of the shrapnel. Soldiers came from nearby to see the church that was bombed but which still stood. Here's the chaplains and teachers, pastors who were doing the evangelism explosion training course with us. One of the trees that had blown over and were filled with shrapnel. But trees were full of shrapnel, but we were not. One of the commanders said to us, this happened to show the power of God. The Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims. Another time, another place. This is a bomb that failed to explode. If it had exploded, it would have taken the church and the compound where we were meeting off the map. Indeed, the Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims. And so we've continued to train chaplains, pastors, medics, teachers throughout Moreland and South Sudan and the Nuba Mountains of Central Sudan. And we can see a great harvest that has come from faithful missionaries like Kenneth and Arlene Fraser, who laid the foundations for the Moro Church to be such a dynamic church it is today. Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Modern detractors of the 19th century missionary movement like to brush aside the historic realities which the missionaries had to confront. They prefer to paint Africa before the influence of the gospel as idyllic and utopian. Kenneth Kaunda, one-time dictator of Zambia, wrote in his book, A Humanist in Africa, that the people of Africa knew nothing about suffering until the missionaries arrived and ruined everything with the gospel. Can you believe it? Kenneth Kaunda's parents were God-fearing Christians who trained in Livingstonia and Malawi as evangelists. Kenneth Kaunda says in his book, A Humanist in Africa, I couldn't agree with the Calvinist faith of my parents who believed in the depravity of man. I don't believe in the sinfulness of man. I believe in the goodness of man. He's a humanist. And you know, Kenneth Kaunda, funny how people who believe in the goodness of man can be so evil and run roughshod over the rights of other people in the name of the goodness of man. Funny how people who believe in the depravity of man can do so much to love their neighbor and to care for others. Zambia is right in the center of southern Africa. Landlocked country. First time I went to Zambia, ended up as a guest of Kenneth Kaunda, presidential detainee in Lusaka Central Prison, right here. I was in cell 11, northern block. Now, when the British built this prison, they built it for 80 prisoners. 80. When I was there, there were 1,200 in this prison that was built to accommodate 80 people. When Kenneth Gonda was locked up here in this prison under the British, he had one cell to himself. When I was locked up there, there were 65 people in a cell. When Kenneth Gonda was locked up in the prison, there was electricity and running water. When we were in there, there was no electricity, no running water. When Kenneth Gonda was locked up by the evil British colonials, he had a bed with sheets and blankets and pillow. He had a sofa. He had a desk. He had books. He had access to the library. He had a gramophone. He had 3 cooked meals brought into a cell daily. When we were there under Kenneth Gonda, who believed in the goodness of man, this unelected dictator of a one-party state, we had only one meal a day, and that came from a big cooking pot, iron pot, and the only food that we got was starch, sadza. That was it, nothing else. The only protein came from the flies who flew into the pot. That was it. There were no plates. Food was dished up on your hands. No spoons, no forks, no cups, nothing. When we were locked up in this prison, people died in the cells and were carried out in the morning. Lusaka Central Prison looks quite nice today because it's got fresh paint on the outside, but it wasn't very nice on the inside. Yeah, we went through the narrow gates, but it didn't look this good at that time. This is what it looks like now. I've been back as a guest speaker, but we didn't even have that much then. Every bit of water had to be carried in buckets. Every bit of filth had to be carried out in other buckets. There were no beds, no bunks. Now, I went to speak this Sunday, last Sunday, in maximum security prison in Barberton. And no prison's nice. I mean, every prison's horrible. But I looked at the clean, polished floors, the bunk beds, the pillows, the mattresses, the showers, the running water, the plumbing, the electricity. I thought, it's like a 5-star hotel, Barberton, compared to Lusaka Central Prison under Gonda. We could not lie on our backs. We could only lie on our sides. There wasn't enough space to lie on your back. 65 people put in a cell, 25 feet by 15 feet. Pace it out. 25 feet by 15 feet. 65 people put in there. No plumbing. No toilets. No running water. No hygiene. Filth. In October 1987, I and 3 other frontline missionaries were imprisoned in Zambia. The frontline mission team I'd been leading was arrested at Cousin Gudu Ferry for refusing to bribe Zambian officials. We spent excruciating weeks of abuse at the hands of the Zambian security forces in filthy cells, blindfolded, handcuffed, interrogated, incarcerated in the overcrowded Lusaka Central Prison. Friends of ours ensured that the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was informed of our plight just before her departure for the Commonwealth Conference in Vancouver. All the Commonwealth countries were coming together in Vancouver, Canada, and the primary goal at that conference in October 1987 was to put pressure on Margaret Thatcher to put economic sanctions on South Africa. This is the heyday of the Cold War. This is at the very high time of the battles in Angola were fierce, huge battles with the Cubans and the Russians in Angola. The Cold War was hot, it was accelerating, and putting economic sanctions on South Africa by Britain was considered a high priority. There, Margaret Thatcher was subjected to haranguing by Zambian dictator Kenneth Gonda, who was the chairman of the frontline states. And he is outraged that Britain was refusing to place economic sanctions on South Africa. So Margaret Thatcher responded by asking, well, why doesn't Zambia herself put sanctions on South Africa? Gonda responded, well, that would place many people out of work. Exactly, responded the British Prime Minister. And as South Africa is one of our most important trading partners, many British citizens would be placed out of work if I were to impose sanctions on South Africa. Quite aside from the many South Africans themselves would be placed out of work. She then went on to relate how Zambians were dependent on South Africa, on South African maize, mealie-meal, grown in the Orange Free State. Zambian Airways was maintained by South African Airways technicians. Zambian Railways was maintained by South African Railways, pulled by South African Railways locomotives, maintained by South African Railways technicians. South African veterinarians cared for Zambia's cattle. Zambians were migrant workers in South Africa. And how much of their money went into the treasury of Zambia? Kenneth Konda then responded that because of South Africa's human rights abuses, Britain should impose sanctions. It was at this point that Margaret Thatcher produced our information. Who are you to talk about human rights abuses? You are the unelected dictator of a one-party state. Four British missionaries. Now, of course I'm South African, but I was born in Cape Town, but because my father fought all 6 years of the Second World War in the 8th Army, I have a British passport too, and at that stage, South African passports were not valid to go to Zambia, so I was using a British passport. And the other three were British missionaries. So four British missionaries were being held without trial as presidential detainees, without charge, in Lusaka Central Prison, and they've been tortured and abused by your own security forces. Margaret Thatcher said a few more things. Kenneth Konda was dumbstruck, humiliated, knocked out. The Iron Lady had knocked him out of the debate. He ordered our immediate release. When Kenneth Konda came back to the SARC, apparently the first words he said when he came down the gangplank was, "Get those missionaries out of here!" And a man from the president's office in a three-piece suit came to the prison. I was called. I expected to be another interrogation, so I came to the gate, put up my hands for handcuff. The man shook my hand and says, "The president has ordered your release." On the way, we passed the Freedom Monument. Now, this picture's taken on a later mission. I wasn't looking that good when I came out of prison, barefoot and tatters and with a beard and all that. But I couldn't help but notice that the Freedom Monument was behind bars. Very symbolic. While in prison, we made many friends. I didn't realize we were going to be spending time with the next government of Zambia. In the presidential detainee's cell was many people from all over Africa who were locked up without trial, without charge, on orders of Kenneth Konda. It included General Godfrey Meander, who later became Vice President and Minister of Education. Good friend. It included, although I didn't meet him, but Frederick Chiluba was also locked up in the Lusaka Central Prison. He wasn't in our cell. I don't recall meeting him, but he became next governor. We made all kinds of friends from there. Interesting how in Africa, today's prisoners could be tomorrow's presidents. In 1991, there was an overthrowing of Kenneth Kaunda's 27-year dictatorship as one-party UNIP state, and Zambia was declared a Christian country. Abortion was made illegal. Pornography was made illegal. Our friends, like General Godfrey Meander, invited us to come and run biblical worldview seminars and teacher training cultures to help them with different things, to speak on the radio programs, to minister in the army bases and to government. We were involved in helping to produce some textbooks and many good friends. This pastor was such a good friend. He was a chaplain who came into the prison while I was locked up there. And he's the one who actually made it known, so it was published in the Zambian Times and newspapers, about four missionaries locked up in Lusaka Central Prison. This is Bishop Bonali Firi of World Baptist Evangelistic Association. He became my best friend. He spoke out for us and got us known outside, so pressure gathered for us our release. When I took to General Godfrey Meander a whole pile of books, he looked at them and he groaned and he said, "I love books, I love reading, but the demands of office give me very little time for reading. Don't you have a small book that summarizes all of these?" So I wrote Biblical Principles for Africa, which you were given yesterday as well. Biblical Principles for Africa was specifically written on the request of the Zambian government, and that's why you'll see on the back of it, endorsement by the Zambian president and the Malawi president, who both ordered hundreds of copies to give to their ministers, the members of parliament. And we've translated since into Afrikaans, into French, taken it to the Congo. Biblical Principles for Africa is one of our best-selling books. We have printed and distributed over 48,000 copies already in three languages. Another good friend we made in Zambia was General Ronnie Shikapashra. Ronnie Shikapashra was head of the Zambian Air Force. He was crippled in a car accident, told he'd never walk again. His wife was converted. He was converted. He was healed. He became Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Home Affairs, Minister of Information. He organized us to meet President Levi Mawanawasa. I had the privilege of spending an hour with President Levi Mawanawasa, who came from a Jehovah's Witness background. He had been kicked out of his church for getting into politics because Jehovah's Witnesses don't allow you to be involved in politics. We had the privilege of sharing the gospel with him, reading in the Bible with him, presenting him with a Christian flag. Shortly after that, he was baptized in Lusaka Baptist Church and became a faithful member of that church for the rest of his life. I've ministered in Zambia with my son. My youngest son, Calvin, has come with me, church conferences, pastoral training courses, and I brought my son along when he was just 8 years old to be able to show the people in Zambia that the men must spend more time training their young people because children can memorize lots. My son was able to recite the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, do evangelism explosion presentations, lead them in the Lord's Prayer and Way of the Master. And so I showed him where we used to swim across the river in Tangola smuggling Bibles. My son would sometimes take classes and assemblies on his own as an eight-year-old because he's been trained in how to share the gospel from time he was five. And many were excited to see this, and in fact it even led to him going on Zambian television to show what he had memorized and to encourage people to teach more memorization to their children. According to people like Kenneth Gounda, all Africans lived in peace and harmony, tranquility and democratic prosperity before the missionaries arrived with the gospel. You might expect such ahistoric ramblings from committed Marxists who hate the gospel. But incredibly, all too many Christians, because of their ignorance of history, repeat these allegations even in Christian publications. Mary Slessor was horrified when she arrived in Calabar, Nigeria, to discover that a woman who gave birth to twins was regarded with horror. The belief was that the father of one of the infants was an evil spirit, and the mother had been guilty of a great sin to bear twins. As a result, at least one of the children was believed to be a monster, so to be safe, they killed both. They seized the twins, broke their backs, crushed them into calabash or water pot, took them out not by the doorway but by a hole broken in the back wall, which was once immediately built up again, and they were thrown into the bush, left to be eaten by insects and wild beasts. Mary Slessor found Calabar in the grip of rampant witchcraft, drunkenness, and immorality. She rescued and adopted and brought up twins. She intervened to prevent a witch doctor from pouring boiling oil over a woman, spread-eagled, staked on the ground. She stood between the witch doctor and the woman and rescued her. Cannibalism and slavery between the tribes was widespread. Once, when instructed to heal a dying chief, Mary knew that if she failed, she'd be blamed for his death. First of all, she got rid of all the witchcraft charms and the sacrificed chickens lying around the hut. Then she prayed, gave the chief good medicine, and nursed him back to health. The wives of the chief were particularly grateful for Mary's success because they would otherwise have been buried, killed and buried with the chief if he had died. These wives were understandably keen to learn about the book which had saved their lives. Samuel Marsden, pioneer missionary to New Zealand, witnessed the depth of degradation and the hold of superstition of the Maori people when the widow of the deceased chief hanged herself with the approval and applause of her parents and brothers. Can you imagine relatives encouraging and applauding their sister or daughter to commit suicide? Cannibalism was rife amongst the Maori. One chief declared that he had eaten 139 people. He knew this, because while he couldn't count before, he had kept one bone from every person he had eaten. And after he was converted, he counted up and he saw he had eaten 139 people. One woman confessed she had killed and eaten 19 children. Missionaries to the New Hebrides found human sacrifice and cannibalism throughout the Pacific Islands. In Fiji, two-thirds of the children were boiled and eaten. Every village had a human butcher. Aged parents were butchered and eaten by their children. Men would even cook their best wife or child as a special feast for their friends. John Patton, missionary to the New Hebrides, reported on an occasion on Tana where three women were killed in a human sacrifice to secure the recovery to health of the chief. When missionary to the South Sea Islands, John Williams was criticized for imposing foreign Christian standards upon unwilling communities living in primitive bliss. He noted these were the same communities where laziness, promiscuity, human sacrifice, and the burial alive of infants had shortly before been commonplace. Far from the missionaries interrupting the peace and tranquility of pagan nations, the missionaries came to nations that were passing through immense upheavals. When Hudson Taylor first landed in Shanghai in 1854, China was being torn apart by a vicious civil war, the so-called Taiping Rebellion. Rebels held the city. 50,000 imperial troops besieged it. The house that Hudson Taylor was staying in was struck with cannon fire, and the house next to his was destroyed. He frequently witnessed people being beheaded. He himself came close to being lynched, hung on occasion. Over 25 million Chinese were killed in two civil wars that raged in the 1850s and 1860s in China. Another 10 million died between 1877 and 1879 during a famine in the north of China. As Dr. George Grant states in the introduction to The Greatest Century of Missions, as missionaries moved out from Christendom to the uttermost parts of the earth, they were shocked to discover all the horrors of untamed heathenism. They found abortion all too prevalent, infanticide all too commonplace, abandonment all too familiar, euthanasia all too customary. They were confronted by the specters of endemic poverty, reoccurring famine, unfettered disease, and widespread chattel slavery. Cannibalism, ritual abuse, patricide, that's the murdering of parents, human sacrifice, sexual perversity, petty tyranny, paternalistic exploitation, live burials, exterminative clan warfare, genocidal tribal vendettas, all predominated. As missionaries circled the globe, penetrated the jungles, and crossed the seas, they preached a singular message: light out of darkness, liberty out of tyranny, life out of death, to cultures endemic with terrible poverty, brutality, lawlessness, and disease. Those faithful Christian witnesses interjected the novel Christian concepts of grace, charity, law, medicine, and the sanctity of life. They overturned despots. They liberated the captives. They rescued the perishing. They established hospitals. They founded orphanages. They started rescue missions. They built almshouses. They opened soup kitchens. They incorporated charitable societies. They changed laws. They demonstrated love. They lived as if people really mattered. Wherever missionaries went, they faced a dual challenge: confront sin in men's hearts, confront sin in men's cultures. The obstacles, the dangers, and the difficulties that they had to face and overcome were staggering. By an act of British Parliament, missionaries in India were illegal. In China, not only was all missionary activity completely illegal, but so too was attempting to learn a Chinese language. There was a ban on any Chinese teaching the language to foreigners. The Chinese tutors to Robert Morrison, the first Protestant missionary to China, carried poison on their bodies so that if they were discovered, they could end their lives quickly and escape torture. Because at that time, the Chinese forbade foreign women on their soil, Robert Morrison had to live apart from his wife Mary for most of their lives. Once they were separated for 6 years. I know people complain about being separated from their husbands for 6 days. 6 years. America's first foreign missionary, Adoniram Judson, was captured on the high seas, incarcerated in a French prison, from which he escaped. Later, he is imprisoned and tortured in death prison Burma for 18 months. You see how they are strung up there by their feet, so that only their shoulders are on the ground at night. They're only let down in the day. They could hardly walk after that. They were virtually crippled. Can you imagine a backache that would come from this? David Livingstone wrote, "We need to be uncommon Christians, that is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct." A mission organization wrote to David Livingstone asking, "Have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to send other men to join you." David Livingstone responded, "If you have men who will come only if there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all." C.T. Studd, the famous cricket captain turned pioneer missionary, declared, "If Jesus Christ be God and died for me, then no sacrifice can be too great for me to make for him." As he suffered malaria and other attacks, C.T. Studd wrote, "Some like to live within sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." In the words of C.T. Studd, Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches, to snatch them from the very jaws of hell, to enlist and train them for Jesus and make them a mighty army of God. But this can only be accomplished by red hot, unconventional, unfettered Holy Spirit religion, by reckless sacrifice and heroism in the foremost trenches. The challenge of David Livingstone rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. Studying the sacrifices and the exploits of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century is most challenging and inspiring. These were ordinary people made extraordinary by a dynamic and vibrant Christian faith, which carried them through some of the worst circumstances imaginable. C.T. Studd wrote, "I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths, but no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. Assent to creed was born again into decisive action of obedience." Hudson Taylor stated that his life was based upon three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken in the Bible. He means what he says, and he will do all that he has promised. Hudson Taylor wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him, of the conviction that never left him that he was called to China. Hudson Taylor agonized in prayer for China, sometimes praying through the night. He wrote of wrestling with his unbelief and how the Lord conquered his unbelief, and he surrendered himself to God for the service. The Great Commission is not an option to be considered. It is a command to be obeyed, he said. At the end of his long life, Hudson Taylor could say, the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him at prayer. Wow. Who can say that? The sun had never risen without finding him at prayer. The battle is the Lord's, he declared, and he will conquer. We may fail. We do fail continually, but he never fails. The pioneer missionaries of the 19th century were inspired by most positive and optimistic faith. They were absolutely convinced that the Lord who gave the Great Commission would enable it to be fulfilled. The will of God will never lead you, or the grace of God cannot keep you. When after 7 years of laboring in China, Robert Morrison saw the first Chinese convert, he wrote, may he be the first fruits of a great harvest, one of millions who will believe and be saved. And you know, today there's over 120 million believers in China. Absolutely staggering. Scotland's first foreign missionary, Alexander Duff, declared, Oh, what promises are ours if we only had the faith to grasp it. What a promise is that in the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations. And lo, I'm with you always to the very end of the world. We go forth amongst the hundreds of millions of the nations. We find gigantic systems of idolatry and superstition consolidated for thousands of years. They tower as high mountains. But what does faith say? Believe and it shall be. And if any church on earth will realize that faith, to that church will honor belong of evangelizing the nations and bringing down the mountains. When after 7 years labor in India, William Carey was able to witness the first convert, the conversion of Krishna Kaul from Hinduism, William Carey declared the divine grace which saved one Indian's heart could obviously change 100,000. You would have thought they'd be discouraged, laboring 7 years before they were the first convert, but they saw it as the first fruits of millions. Today, there's over 25 million Christians in India. William Carey planted good seed, which has produced a good harvest. William Carey declared, the work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country with the knowledge of Christ. We're neither working at uncertainty, nor are we afraid for the result. Christ must reign until Satan has not one inch of territory. God's cause will triumph. In the words of William Carey's historic sermon, which launched the modern missionary movement, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. God is great. Honor him with great faith. By God's grace, Carey was able to successfully campaign against the Hindu practice of suti, where widows were burned alive on the funeral pyres of their deceased husbands. Carey also ended the practice of burning lepers alive. William Carey established the first newspaper ever printed in an Oriental language. He introduced the steam engine to India. He pioneered lending libraries. He introduced savings banks. He pioneered forest conservation. He established the first college in Asia, the first Christian college in Asia, Serampore College, which is still training leaders. He succeeded in producing and distributing over 200,000 Bibles, New Testaments or Gospels, in 36 languages. In addition to many books and tracts. By God's grace, through the ministry of Mary Slessor, the killing of twins ceased. Slave trading in Calabar was eradicated. Drunkenness and killing and witchcraft diminished. Many schools and churches were established, including this one, which she physically helped to build. Most of the people of Calabar came to embrace the gospel of Christ. The first public Christian worship service in New Zealand was conducted on Christmas Day 1814 by Samuel Marsden. By 1845, it was reported that 98% of the Maoris, the cannibals, had embraced Christianity. By the time John Williams was clubbed to death and eaten by cannibals on the island of Erromonga in 1839, he had succeeded in transforming scores of islands by the scriptures he had translated, the schools he had established, the churches he had built, and many thousands of islanders had come to salvation in Christ. John Williams had been converted 25 years earlier by a sermon based on what is a man profited if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? True to that verse that he had heard on the night of his conversion in 1814, John Williams found his life by losing it for Christ. By the way, he was ordained as a missionary of London Missionary Society in the same service as Robert Moffat. Robert Moffat came to South Africa. John Williams went to the Pacific. Frank Patton followed in his father, John Patton's footsteps, and became a missionary to the island where his father had been forced to flee for his life 34 years before. During his ministry there, Frank was blessed to see the whole population of Tana won for Christ. Many islands in the Pacific, it says, they have memorials saying this, before the missionaries arrived, there were no Christians. When they left, there were no heathen. Similarly, Robert Morrison had the joy of seeing his son, John Morrison, follow in his footsteps and pour his heart and soul into the work of bringing the gospel to the people of China. All of Adoniram Judson's five surviving children grew up and distinguished themselves in Christian service. He had 10 children. 5 of his children died in the field. But of the 5 who survived, they all distinguished themselves in Christian service. Robert Moffat, who produced the first complete translation of the Bible into an African language, the Tswana language, had the joy of seeing 5 of his 7 children actively involved in missionary service. His son, John Moffat, established the first mission station amongst the Madibili, amongst whom I grew up. 2 of C.T. Studd's daughters, who had been born in China, came out and joined him with their husbands in his Heart of Africa mission, including Edith Studd, who became Edith Buxton. She wrote, reluctant missionary, went to the Congo. Her husband became a great missionary in Abyssinia and translated the Bible into Abyssinian. One of the many fruits of William Wilberforce's lifelong crusade against the slave trade was that Samuel Ajay Crowther, who was born in Yorubaland in 1807, the year Great Britain abolished the slave trade, Samuel Crowther became the first African bishop of the Church of England. Samuel Crowther was born in Yorubaland. At age 13, he was captured by African slave traders, sold to a Portuguese trader for transportation across the Atlantic. Samuel was rescued by a British naval squadron in 1822, put ashore at Freetown. From 1809, the British government mobilized the Royal Navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. For a century, the Royal Navy was dedicated to freeing slaves, setting the captives free, going far beyond clearing the oceans of slave ships. They boldly sailed up uncharted rivers and creeks. They stormed slave stockades. They freed captives at every turn for a century. Here's some of the slaves freed from one of the slave ships off Zanzibar. Great Britain dedicated its resources to fighting and opposing the slave trade. The British spent millions of pounds in suppressing the slave trade, and they sacrificed much blood in fighting to set the captives free throughout the world on every continent. The West African country of Sierra Leone was established by British evangelicals, part of William Wilberforce's Clapham community, to serve as a haven for freed slaves. Britain invested vast amounts of money into developing Sierra Leone as a free and independent state where liberated slaves could settle, and therefore its capital is called Freetown. In Sierra Leone, Samuel Crowther, who had been rescued in the Atlantic, was now converted to Christ. He received an education both in Sierra Leone and in England. About the 3rd year of my liberation from the slavery of man, I was convinced of another worse state of slavery, that of sin and Satan. I was admitted to the visible Church of Christ here on earth as a soldier to fight manfully under his banner against spiritual enemies. In 1843, Samuel was ordained as a Church of England minister for service in the Church Missionary Society. Crowther was one of the leaders of a successful missionary venture that took him and several other former slaves back to native Yorubaland, where vigorous Christianity soon developed. One of the first converts Samuel baptized was his own mother, who took the Christian name Hannah. So she was Hannah, he was Samuel, given to the Lord, received back from the Lord. His language, Yoruba, became the first African language for use for the Church of England liturgy in worship. Yoruba Christian worship was distinctly Protestant and evangelical in the Church of England style. Crowther led converts in burying or destroying their traditional charms, fetishes, and idols. In 1864, Samuel Crowther was ordained the first African bishop of the Church of England in an overflowing Canterbury cathedral. He was directed to undertake a mission along the Niger River. This was to follow up on the Niger expedition of 1841, which was led by William Wilberforce's successor, Foxtel Buxton. T. Foxtel Buxton was an evangelical leader in Parliament and an anti-slavery crusader. His expedition up the Niger River Valley of West Africa was to overcome the ravages of the slave industry still entrenched there. Of the 145 Europeans on that expedition, 130 were struck down with fever, with malaria, and 40 died. Imagine, one mission, 40 people dying. Yet the expedition was successful. It succeeded in establishing a missionary center at Foro Bay, for training liberated slaves to evangelize West Africa. It was built in the very place where the slave market had once stood. The rafters of its roof were made almost entirely from masts taken from old slave ships and donated by the Royal Navy for this purpose. Samuel Crowther was one of the first four students to graduate from Foro Bay College, the first university in sub-Saharan Africa. Samuel labored diligently to bring the gospel to the diverse tribes in the Niger River, producing biblical tracts and scripture texts dealing with witchcraft and charms. Here was being shown by the custodian of the mission house of the Church Missionary Society in Badagra and showing the translation work done by Samuel Crowther. He also dealt with common ground between the Quran and the scriptures. He produced gospel presentations for Muslims founded entirely on gospel quotations. Crowther wrote in 1854 of his contact with King Ogara of Panda. I asked if he'd like his people to be taught God's book and how to worship God as we do in the white man's country. For it was these two things together which made England great, and that they would bring peace and prosperity to any country who received and embraced them. He replied that he is very desirous that wars should cease, that his people might trade, and that they may be taught God's book, and he wished us many blessings. Samuel Crowther was effective in opposing slavery, witchcraft, and Islam. He won many converts amongst the Noop and the Hausa. Bishop Crowther worked effectively at indigenizing an evangelical Anglicanism, which is truly African. Today, there are over 18 million Anglicans in Nigeria. In fact, there are vastly more Anglicans worshiping every Sunday in Nigeria than there are in all of the British Isles and North America combined, in terms of Anglicans. And you could say the same for Nigeria, as for Uganda, as for Sudan. There are more Anglicans in church every Sunday in Sudan than there are in the British Isles and North America in church every Sunday. Missions is the lifeblood of the church, and it is absolutely essential that our congregations and our families be presented with these and many other blessings and examples of those who God blessed in such extraordinary ways. We need to read these examples. We need to feed our minds and our souls with examples of excellence. I pray that these few selected adventures, sacrifices, exploits, pictures, and achievements will whet your appetite to read the Great Essential of Missions book, which you all have now as your own copy, and to obtain more missionary biographies, to start the lifelong habit of making time to feed your mind and your soul with the noblest object which can engage the enthusiasm of man, the salvation of millions. May God be pleased to use the Great Essential of Missions to inspire a new generation of missionaries to expect great things from God and to attempt great things for God. One who answered the call was David Brainerd, whose journal included this prayer. Here I am. Send me. Send me to the rough, the savage pagans of the wilderness. Send me from all that is called comfort on earth. Send me even to death itself, if it be but in thy service and to promote thy kingdom. You only have one life. It'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last. So, are there any questions? The Great Essential of Missions, these examples of excellence. You'll find many useful materials on our frontlinemissionsa.org website, especially to inspire one. And if you go onto Facebook, you'll find the Frontline Fellowship site. Any questions, any comments? I can tell you where that's come from. Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin, the communists started these lies to distract people from Christianity, turn them away. Voltaire, who was the revolutionary writer, the Karl Marx of the French Revolution. Voltaire is the one who invented the term the Dark Ages. So he turned the Christian Middle Ages, when Europe was being converted from barbarianism, from savagery, from Roman slavery, and were being brought into gospel and building the cathedrals and the hospitals and the libraries, they called it the Dark Ages. It's a lie. There was no Dark Ages in Europe. The Middle Ages were the Christian Ages. When they were building cathedrals with stained glass windows, how's that the Dark Ages? But Voltaire coined the term the Dark Ages for when Europe was converted from barbarianism into Christianity. And then it's the communists like Lenin and Karl Marx who taught that missionaries brought colonialism, oppression, slavery. It's a total lie. What I've seen is the biggest racists are the ones screaming racism all the time. The biggest colonialists are the ones screaming against colonialism. The biggest imperialists are the ones screaming against imperialism. The biggest thieves are the ones causing other people to be. Take Robert Mugabe. Mugabe is the most vile racist dictator, oppressor, exploiter, thief. He has stolen. Zimbabwe has got the richest diamond fields in the world today, the Mereng diamond fields, none of which money comes to the Zimbabwe people, all of which went to China and to Mugabe. Mugabe's personal wealth was $15 billion. He's got castles in Scotland, palaces in Dubai. He's got all over the world, French Riviera. He's got massive Swiss bank accounts. And Mugabe has the audacity to speak about the whites, the colonials, the missionaries. He's the biggest lying, thieving, mass-murdering enemy of the people. What he did to the Madibili, the butchering and so on. No, this is typical. The communists need to distract you. If somebody wants to steal your handbag or pick your pocket, what must they do? Distract you. Either they distract you or another team member distracts you from this side while they're picking your pocket or stealing your handbag from this side. Thieves need to distract you. Lying politicians need to distract people. If you can just get rid of that statue or these farms or whatever, and meanwhile, they're looting. The African Union says every year, African governments steal 25% of the GDP, the gross domestic product, through corruption alone. That's not counting the inflation, the taxation, and all the other theft, but straight corruption, 25%. You are paying vastly more for everything than you ever should because of government corruption. And the most thieving, lying governments are trying to say the problem is the people who gave their lives, bringing literacy, the wheel, written languages, the Bible, medicines, who doubled and trebled our life expectancy, they're the evil ones. It's laughable deception, and we should not have anything to do with it. I got my doctorate in the 19th century missionary movement. This book that you've got, The Greatest Century Missions, is the popular version of that study. And the main theme of my doctorate was what inspired the greatest century of missions, and I put down Calvinism and postmillennialism in a nutshell. So in this book, though, I've tried to make popularly available the insights that I learned getting the original books, discovering first editions, and I've got first editions, all the first editions of David Livingstone and other great missionaries like that in our mission house. And before political correctness and the distorting of things, getting in there and finding what really happened, what really was said, what Africa was like before the gospel came. And there's so much more to learn. But anyway, let's not accept the lies of this world. Because, you know, when people are distracting you and they're accusing someone else, it's often for a purpose that they're trying to steal more from you. And they are trying to steal everything. I see an anti-Christian agenda here. The lies of these people. People who support communism and abortion and blasphemy and corruption and all these other things. And they are trying to accuse the most unselfish people in history who sacrificed so much that we could have the greatest and blessings of all. And it went beyond all of that to fighting slavery, to uplifting the people, bringing schools, hospitals, medicine. The fact is that our life expectancy in Africa has been trebled as a result of the missionaries coming. Trebled. And now they're trying to make a big thing about how terrible they were. I've been hearing these lies since I was converted, and I'm sick of it, which is just another reason why I had to produce this book, to give the facts of what was going on. We're living in a very self-centered and deceived age. I think we are in the most propagandized age in history. Because of TV, newspapers, so on, there's a lot of, in the hands of anti-Christian secular pagans. You can see how the people in the media like blasphemy, they like pornography, they like abortion, they like everything except Christianity, they love humanism, Islam, anything else, but they hate Christianity and they hate Christ. So why should we believe them or trust them in anything they want to tell us? So we need to be very skeptical and cynical when the world is telling us anything. They lie. That's why there's so many warnings in the Bible. Do not be deceived. Any other questions before we break for tea? Yes. I would love to give you a presentation, Mary Slessor. There's a chapter on her in the Great Essential Missions book, of course, as there is on Samuel Crowther and other great missionaries. So, of course, I've given you yesterday just William Carey. There are 19 different missionaries that we have chapters on in the Great Essential Missions book. Mary Slessor is one of them. She is one of the very first single missionaries to go to the field, female single missionaries. Because women went to the mission field as a wife before, like Mary Moffat or Mary Livingston. But Mary Slessor was very, very brave. She went out as a single woman, and she had a chance to get married. But because he wouldn't join her in the mission field, she broke the engagement. That's how dedicated she was to the field. Mary Slessor, a wonderful example. What she did and how she did it, absolutely extraordinary. And by the way, she's also called the barefoot missionary. She was as tough as nails. And she was even more poverty-stricken than David Livingstone. David Livingstone was brought up in a small home where there was one little room for the family of seven. But he at least had a loving father and loving mother. Mary Slessor didn't even have that. She had a drunkard, abusive father. She had to be working from age 10 already in the cotton mills full time. And Mary Slessor was even poorer than David Livingstone. And yet she went out and she made such an impact. Wonderful examples.